What up? Mutant City Horror. Paul Solo. It's cracking, everybody. Man, I feel like it's been a minute. You know what's funny is we've been pushing out content on a weekly basis, getting a little bit more regular now that Reedy's in the mix, and we've just a little behind the scenes here. We've redistributed some of the workloads, and Reedy's chipping in with the editing, and Matt's getting us tight with our scheduling, and it's all starting to work like a fully functional podcast. Weird. But it does feel like it's been a minute since I've been on the microphone, and maybe that's because we got a bunch of shit in the can, and sometimes we skip a week, and sometimes, you know, we double up or whatever, but nah, man, it's good. Loving it. It's going great. What's up, everybody? This week, we're posting on a Tuesday. Turning up on a Tuesday. Sorry. Anyways, that's because Monday was a holiday. Figured nobody would listen. You might miss your notification. So I'm going to be dropping this on Tuesday, the day after Memorial Day. And hopefully you guys get a kick out of this one. This one's really cool. I was so honored to be able to sit down with a legendary effects artist who's been in the industry for like 40 plus years. Goes by the name of Joe Castro. You might have heard his name once or twice on this podcast before, but if you are a horror fan through and through, then odds are you've probably seen a lot of his work. Joe is a fantastic human being. I will never be able to stop saying enough good things about him, his partner Steven. The fact that like he was so willing to allow us to come in, not to just his workshop, but into his home, like, I love that. Thank you, Joe. That's fantastic. I do have to give props where props are due. However, this meeting Joe Castro has been a treat because we've met him through our relationship with Dirty Freaking Joe. Joe Castro worked on the Sci-Fi Sam video for Dirty Freaking Joe, and they've worked on some other stuff in the background as well on other projects. And so they have a really good working relationship going. And so, you know, we met Joe Castro through Dirty Freaking Joe. And to be honest, a lot of the people that we do meet is because of Dirty Freaking Joe. So he is somebody I will always pay homage to because he's a superhuman. We love him so much on the show, and we're so thankful for everything that he does for us, people he introduces us to, opportunities that he provides to us. So Dirty Joe, if you're listening, love you, bro. As far as our interview with Joe Castro, like I said, you know, I was able to come out to his house and take a look at the workshop and get, you know, a real good in-depth story of who Joe Castro is and what he's kind of overcome over the last 40 years in the industry, and some of the ups and downs he's had with being an effects artist, and, you know, just all of the regular kind of roadblocks that one would encounter, especially when it comes to being a minority and, you know, just all that stupid shit, the politics that comes with the industry, which doesn't really matter at the end of the day because he produces quality stuff. Now, I know there's an audio only format, so I apologize in advance. I do have video as a video interview. That stuff's going to be going on our YouTube channel in a while. I don't know when. It takes me fucking forever to do it. But I promise that it will get up there. And when we do that, we'll let you know in whatever episode we're posting that that's there. Also, if you're not already following us on Instagram, please go and do that because that is where you're going to get the most up-to-date information on everything that we're doing outside of this podcast. So that's a good place to start if you're looking for when that stuff gets posted to the YouTube channel. Outside of that, like I said, you know, we got to spend the night with Joe a couple hours at his place, and we talk about his you know, his portfolio stuff that he's worked on throughout the years. You know, I think the crown jewel in his crown. Does that work that way? Anyways, the Terror Toon series is something that he is highly proud of, and I can't promote enough. So if you haven't already seen that stuff, after you're done listening to this episode, I hope it inspires you enough to go back and listen, you know, watch some of the stuff that is in his catalog, especially those Terror Toon films. The Sci-Fi Sam video, of course, like I said, is the, you know, kind of how we started to get to know Joe. But Joe's worked on all kinds of stuff dating as far back as like 91. If you look at his IMDb page, there's a movie on there, his first directed movie called Ceremony, which I started watching. There is a version of it on YouTube that you can go and check out. But it was so funny. I was listening to the VHS Doom podcast this weekend. Shout out to Dylan and Mikey and Bearded Villain over at VHS Doom. Love you guys. But I said before, and it was never more truer than this weekend, right? So today is Monday, May 27th. And I was listening to their episode that just got posted on Saturday, so 2 days ago. And they interviewed an effects artist, right? Someone who's worked in the industry as well. His name is escaping me at the moment, but he did work on the original Mutilator movie, which I thought was funny to me because Joe Castro also did the effects for Mutilator 2. And then I've said before, VHS Doom and Mutant City Horror we run in parallel so much without even like thinking about it. And so the idea that we are both pushing out special effects interview episodes this week is just it's weird, man. But we fucking love VHS Doom. We love collaborating with them and we love listening to theirs. Theirs is a very unique show that I don't think is being matched by any other. So if you hadn't heard us say it enough, please go follow, subscribe, you know, find VHS Doom wherever you can. They got some merch that you can buy that's pretty dope too. So please go and check that out as well. Spotify and Apple Podcasts, VHS Doom Podcast. Instagram is at VHS Doom Podcast. And then you could just find all their shit from there. So yeah, make sure you hit them up. But anyways, so not only are they pushing out a special effects artist interview episode this week, not only did that guy work on Mutilator, which Joe Castro worked on Mutilator 2, but Dylan does this thing where he watches videos in the background when he's streaming with the video conferencing with Mikey. And Dylan had on Near Death, which is directed by Joe Castro. And so a lot of that episode, especially in the beginning, they're talking about Joe Castro and his movie Near Death. And I was just like, fuck, man, we're always kind of in sync in that way. It's kind of weird. But, you know, Joe's worked on a ton of other shit. He's worked with almost everybody in the industry. He has worked on some things that I really want to see, like Brig Freakin' Rat. That was a movie that was also done by a production house called Rad Cine. I have an interview with them that I'm working on right now. I'm not ready to post, but Rad Cine is a movie studio out of Hollywood, California. And we were, very, very honored to come to the movie studio and get some behind the scenes stuff on that shit. But Brig Freakin' Rat, Mutilator 2, like I said, Xenophobia, Legend of the Chupacabra, like just Joe Castro's catalog can go on and on. So what I'll do is I'll just shut the fuck up. I'll let you listen to the interview. And then when you're done, go and check out his catalog and just do a deep dive into the craziness, the authenticness, the genuine love for the craft that is Joe Castro. So anyways, check it out. Make sure you also follow Joe on Instagram at, what's his name here? Joe_Castro_director. And he's always posting some really awesome shit. All of his stuff is so lifelike, so real. Like when you see the videos on our Instagram and on the YouTube, it's really hard to not think that this shit is real, but it's that fucking good. So anyways, thank you again, Dirty Freakin' Joe, for hooking it up. Thank you so much, Joe Castro, for allowing us into your home. And then we hope you all enjoy. We'll see you on the next one. Peace.
Okay.
Okay, so why don't we start with who you are and what you do?
I don't even know who I am. Who am I? Hey, I'm Joe Castro. I'm a Hollywood special effects artist. I've been working in the business for 42 years now. And yeah, I made my first rubber mask when I was 12 years old. Yeah, and I got my first paycheck that year too. Someone gave me like $50 to like make something that year, you know? Yeah.
So. Now, we're sitting in your studio.
Should I close this door? I mean, because
maybe.
Like, there's like a direct flight of let me see. I don't know if it's gonna help or not. Yeah, it'll help a little bit.
Awesome, thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so 42 years, first paycheck when you were 12. How do you, like, what was the genesis of you saying, I want to put some masks together?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. So what was the genesis of me wanting to, like, be a special effects artist?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's a great, great question. So my father was taking care of me, like, when I was 7 years old, because my mother had, like, gone away, like, on a trip with her friends from work. And I think my brother was out of town, too. My brother was, I have an older brother, 3 years older. He was somewhere else, too. And my father was like, sit down and watch this while I go and work, like, out on the ranch. I grew up on a goat ranch.
All
right. He's like, sit here and watch this movie on TV on a Saturday afternoon, and don't get in trouble, right? I'm gonna go do some work on the ranch. And it was Godzilla versus the Smog Monster.
Hell yeah.
And I had never seen, like, a movie, like, by myself ever. So I was seven, and I saw Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. And when it was done, I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. I was like, Dad, how do they do that? And he's like, that's special effects, son. And so we were like watching the credits roll, and then said there, you know, it was in Japanese, but it was like, you know, special effects. Yeah. And that's where it all began.
So you go from being seven to watching Godzilla, and you're like, I want to do all of that.
Yeah, literally from that moment forward, it was like everything I did, everything I've done has led up to this right now. Like,
yeah.
So I moved with purpose, right? Like, I immediately began like, making masks, you know, getting ready to make a rubber mask. How do I make a rubber mask? Like, how do I learn how to make a rubber mask? I was seven, right? So I knew I needed like a camera, right? I knew I needed to learn how to make a rubber mask. And so it went to like paper mache masks. I think I was 10 years old. My mother bought me this like this college level art book, and it had like these different tests in this book, and the tests were actually making pieces of art.
Nice.
And so she's like, we'll start at the beginning. So, and I remember like one of them was like making these like maracas, like, or these like, what do they call it? What are they?
Yeah.
And I made them with like chupacabra heads, you know, and you made them over like a light bulb, and you paper show it outside. Okay. And break it, you know. So it was just like learning like that. So then from there, you know, I came to a family reunion where I met these third cousins that I had never met before, and they were, I think I was 11, and they were, I want to say, 31, 32 years old, and it was Eddie and Ernest Perez, and they were twins, they were fraternal twins, but they were both horror junkies, and I had no idea. This was 1981, and they're like literally sitting at the kiddies table, like with me and the kids, because there was no room. It was a big family, and we started talking about monsters and dinosaurs and stuff and Godzilla, and he started taking me on weekends to, like, I saw every horror movie there was in like the next like 2 or 3 years. Like, literally, he fed me every single horror movie that had ever been made, and he had like this giant collection of VHS tapes, like pirated VHS tapes, of like every horror movie, every foreign film. You know, I had a chance to see City of the Living Dead at the movie theater when it was released. I saw The Toxic Avenger at the movie theater when it was released. I saw, like, you know, I saw all those movies like literally at the theater when they were first released. So, you know, that's just kind of like my education. And then he bought me a book that taught me how to make a rubber mask when I was 12 years old. That guy did. Yeah, Eddie did. Yeah.
Okay, but I'm still a little curious. Like, what is it about the makeup, the special effect, or the practical effect? Like, what is it that you saw in that where you're like, I want to do that?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Let me think. Well, as an adult, I could give you a theory of what it is.
Sure.
I don't know if that I will ever know, but...
You can't remember 40 plus years ago?
Nah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, what I mean is like, if I look back on it now, okay, we're going to get like super serious.
Sure.
Yeah. So like, when I was growing up, I was like brutally beaten by my family.
Mm.
Like, seriously. Like my mother was my biggest bully. And so she literally taught my family members how to beat me. because I grew up as a gay child, and she did not want a gay child, right? Mm. So I was super talented, like from I remember when I was like 4 or 5 years old, I did this like finger painting of a clown, and it looked nothing like anybody else's in the class. It looked like an actual clown, like nice. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like Monet or somebody mm-hmm. had done it. You know, it was like artistic. And I remember my dad said, "This is really good." This was like when I was five. So why did I want to do this? Because whenever I did art, I was like rewarded. I was like, you know, I felt amazing, right?
Got it.
And so this is something that I knew I could do. I could learn how to do, and you know, and I think it kind of carries over in today, you know, like nice. This kind of thing. Yeah.
So the first mask you made when you were 12, what was it for?
Oh, that's a good question. So I had got a video camera. I finally my parents purchased a video camera that year for me. Which is incredible if you think about it. This is 1982, and my mother was a school teacher, and my father was a goat farmer.
Okay.
And video cameras cost $2,200.
Fuck.
That was 1982. So I don't know if they paid for it all themselves or they got some money from my grandparents, because my grandparents were also very well off.
And this is like a VHS camcorder?
Yeah, like a camcorder. Like, so it was like the very first ones on the market, first of all.
Big ass ones.
And also it was portable.
Nice.
So it was even like more special than anybody yeah. could. So
it makes me think of the one from Back to the Future, you know, he's got the big
I would carry it on my side with a thing with a charger and then it a cord, you know. So anyways, and so they bought it for me, and when they gave it to me for Christmas, because I kind of guilt, see, like, this is kind of bizarre, but see, if I would get punished severely, right, by these people, but then I could guilt them into getting whatever I wanted. You know?
So, I see it.
See how that works?
Yeah.
So it's like, I can't change my childhood because of what they did to me, I was able to get what I wanted, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
Anyways, so I was 12 years old in Helotes, Texas. My mother was a high school teacher, and my father was a goat farmer, and they ended up buying me the very first portable VHS camcorder on the market. It was $2,200, which is a lot of fucking money
right.
for 1982 for that household income. Anyways, so I got the video camera, and my friend, my cousin Eddie, he would show me like the most like graphic, disturbing movies that made. And like these were like basically X, right? Like X horror films,
sure.
Like from like Italy and Spain and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there was this one movie called Doctor. Have you seen it? It's called Dr. Butcher, M.D. The medical deviant from hell.
No, but now that I have it on tape, I'm gonna go look it up.
Yeah, it's Dr. Butcher, M.D. The medical deviant from hell. I think it's actually there's another title for it, and it's called, I want to say, Cannibal Holocaust. It might be Cannibal Holocaust or Zombie Holocaust. It's very obscure. It's kind of obscure, but it's called Dr. Butcher, M.D. Anyways, he showed me. He goes, "Joe, you live on a goat ranch. Why don't you make what did he say? Dr. Butcher, G.D. the goat deviate from hell. So because we had a slaughterhouse and we could like, you know, they butchered goats on the property and there were skulls and it was just disgusting. So I made like a rubber mask of like a decapitated goat, like a demon goat thing, you know. That was the first thing I did.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
So then fast forward to.
I'm not now, hold on, I'm super serious to find out what the other title of that is.
Because Cannibal Holocaust is a thing.
It's not Cannibal Holocaust. Dr. Butcher, M.D.
I didn't know. Yeah, I don't know that it has a
different name. Yeah, Zombie Holocaust is what it's called. Okay. Zombie Holocaust. This is the poster.
I think I've seen a picture to it.
That's the poster.
All right.
That movie will make you ill. It will like literally make you. This guy's like does like brain surgery on actual, you know, like the cadavers, and they come back. Dr. Butcher, M.D. Yeah, that's it right there. And
So what do you make the goat head for? Just to make it?
No. I made it. I put together a story like. You know, they were gonna butcher this goat, and the, you know, with the way they went about doing, they sacrifice it like to the devil or something like that, and it brings about this like goat deviant thing, you know, and probably one of the most damaging things I ever did in my entire life as a child was choosing the goat to be butchered on camera for this thing. Now, see, we grew up on a goat ranch where we butchered goats and we sold the meat, and we did it every week. Well, like it happened every day, every week.
Gotcha. Almost.
Like there was a goat being butchered. Like
normal for you.
Totally normal.
Yeah.
But I had to choose, like even though we weren't going to eat it right then and there, it was going to be butchered and it was going to be put like in a freezer and then it was going to be sold. But because I chose the goat to be butchered, it scarred me for the fucking rest of my life into this very day. Okay, don't ever choose an animal to be butchered. It's twisted, especially for, you know, like for the moment it was for entertainment purposes. If you think about it,
right?
Even though it was going to be eaten, and I can still hear it screaming for this very moment. Yeah.
So would it have been different for you? If you just said
I didn't have to use a real goat. I could have just pretended. We didn't have to kill it.
But you grew up on a goat farm.
But I didn't. See, I grew up with like really bad examples, because men then, like especially in South Texas and in the film industry in the 80s, 70s, 80s, they were still learning themselves. We don't use real animal parts in movies these days.
Right.
We like never, not even real bugs. You know.
Right.
And so like if you go back and watch like movies from the 70s and 80s that had like real animals being butchered and that stuff, they were actually financial flops. They were like cursed. It's like cursed cinema.
Mm.
And I like whenever I work on a movie these days, even if there's like a scene with an animal or this and that, even like a real cow skull or like a real animal bone, I don't want that around me. I don't want it on set.
Mm.
I don't have anything to do with that stuff.
It's bad juju. You're
bad juju.
Yeah.
The original movie Dune, the one that David Lynch did, which was a complete box office bomb.
Right.
There's a scene in that film where they go into like this lair where they eat. I guess they murder some of the humans of the emperor's playthings or whatever. And they have all these like animal intestines and stuff all over the ground. They're spraying it with water, and it's real animal parts.
Oh shit!
Curse the fucking movie.
I'm gonna look out for that now.
Yeah, you can't do that. Don't do it.
So did you filmed all that stuff?
Yeah, we filmed a goat being butchered and the whole bit, and then the goat was butchered, and then then I put a person in the same position that the goat was being butchered, and we cut open his stomach and pulled out his guts. So it was like this ritual, and it was just insane. I mean, like I actively participated in things as a child that I would never, ever have any child do. I have no idea. I just grew up in a really screwed up time.
I think in some way, shape, or form, we can all say that.
I don't know about this, though, no.
That's the thing about hindsight. It's 2020, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, no, I would never do that again.
What the fuck?
So
where's that movie at? How do I watch that?
That movie was recorded over.
It
was literally recorded over.
On purpose, though? On purpose?
No, it was an accident. One of my family members recorded over it. Yeah,
that's the worst, man.
Yeah, I recorded over. But you know what? I have stuff from my childhood, like on pictures and stuff, that I will never post simply because there's like little elements of that kind of behavior in it.
Yeah, I get you.
And I don't want to ever like relish in or promote or like try to further myself with that kind of juju around
here.
So I've learned how to like totally, you know, omit that from my life. But yeah, back in the day, like all the big, I'm not going to throw out any names because you can easily do research, but you know, all the Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead movies and all those movies, they were all using real animal parts. And you know, if you ever see a movie that has like an actual like brain in it, it's like it's an animal brain pretending to be a human brain from like the 70s or 80s. They had to literally go and kill the animal that day because brains don't stay in the shape of a brain. They like they if you freeze them and you unthaw it, it will melt. So it's like they like literally if you see like a brain in a movie and it looks like the shape of a brain, it's because they killed the animal like an hour or two before.
Holy shit. That's insane.
So, you know, like I said, I had bad examples growing up. If you're a special effects artist, like right now from my age, they will all agree that we had some bad examples of things they did. When you see bugs in film being like smashed and killed and it's a real bug, we don't do that. It's a CGI bug. No one cares if it's a real bug or not these days. But yeah, all that stuff is very
taboo.
Yeah, I almost see none of that in my films.
And there's so many different organizations that care about you killing bugs.
Well, it's not really a form of art. Like we make movies for art and entertainment, and it's not entertaining to see a thing die. And also, we have the capability these days to do that. What we're trying to accomplish without actually having to hurt an animal.
Yeah.
I mean, like I can build a bug. I can do it either visually, or visual effects, or with practical effects, and I prefer to do it that way.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're 12 when this thing is shot, right?
Uh-huh.
So this is 82.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Your first directed movie is, don't tell me, hold on, I remember the name of it, as, it's on the top of my, don't tell me. I was just watching it too. Starts with a C.
It will, what? That one is the first one that I directed in Hollywood, but I did direct a feature film even before that.
Which one was that?
I did two, actually. One of them was called The Trouble with Meteorites.
Okay.
And I did that back in Texas. And then I did a movie called The Year of Terror. We both are up on, I think they're up on Vimeo. You can watch them on Vimeo. But you're talking, thinking about Ceremony.
I am thinking about Ceremony.
You're not Ceremony,
yeah. Fuck, I was just talking to Joe about it, too.
You know, Vincent Price was supposed to be in that film.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, Vincent Price was going to be in the movie. He was going to be the lead actor in the film. And literally, like, I want to say, like, 2 weeks before we were going to shoot the film, he was bedridden. He was, you know, he was, like, he was at home. He was here in L.A. He was bedridden. And he did Edward Scissorhands before that. That was the last one before that. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote the role in the film. If you see Ceremony, the lead, the name talent is Forrest Ackerman, and he's like in a wheelchair at one point, and then he's in a hospital bed in like a home. Like
that's
home hospital
more in the beginning, right?
Yeah, the film. Yeah. So that role was written for Vincent Price because he was actually bedridden.
Makes sense.
And like 2 weeks before we shot the film, his manager convinced him not to do the movie and to let Edward Scissorhands be his last film. God, can you imagine? It's just that's the way it goes down.
Damn, that sucks, man. Down. I know, dude. It's just, it's the most. I want to
end that on a lighter note. But Forrest G. Ackerman ended up being the lead name talent in the film, and it was a blessing in disguise because Forrest G. Ackerman is like Forrest G. Ackerman is the reason why you and I are having this podcast right now. You just don't know it. You know who Forrest G. Ackerman is?
No, I don't know who he is.
Forrest G. Ackerman is the very first horror groupie ever. Okay, when he was a kid, he would literally sneak onto the back lot of Universal Studios and like when they were shooting like Dracula and Frankenstein, all that stuff. And you're like, you know, there were no fences in. I guess it was just fields or whatever, right? And so he was the first man to make a horror magazine for the fans.
Okay.
It was called Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Oh, nice.
See, so because of him, we have horror conventions and horror podcasts and all this kind of like horror fandom.
Damn, I feel like someone's going to revoke my horror card.
And see, you know the term sci-fi?
Mm-hmm.
That man invented that term.
Damn.
Yeah, Forrest G. Ackerman. So he's the star of my very first feature film.
Okay, so I'm interested how you go from making this goat movie to getting like Hollywood films, like what's the progression like there?
So back in the day, we used to have this thing called be pen pals, and we used write each other letters and literally put it in a mail, and then we'd wait like 7 days for them to get it, and then they'd write a letter and send it back, right? Or if you could, we'd call on the telephone on the weekends when it was cheaper for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes or whatever.
Yep.
And that kind of thing. So I had pen pals all over the United States.
Nice.
That wanted to do the same thing because we would have subscriptions to Famous Monsters, the magazine. Fangoria used to do a thing where if you bought a subscription to Fangoria, they would give you like three little lines in the back of the book, in the back of the magazine, where you could like say whatever you wanted. And so we'd be like, hi, I'm Joey Castro. Here is my phone number. I'm a special effects artist. Call me.
All right.
Yeah. So people would call it, we'd call each other, and it was, that's how we corresponded with each other.
Dude, that's so awesome.
Yeah. So, what was the question again? We would correspond with each other. I had a friend in high school, and a friend that lived like right up the road from me, another friend. And they were both interested in doing special effects. So they had one of them had a video camera as well, and we'd make short films together. And I convinced my other friend, who was two years older than me, to drive with me out to LA to try to get a job as a special effects artist. And I had a pen pal that was in Florida that had moved out here, and he started working when he got out here on some projects. And he said, hey, Joe, I got a movie, and I'm trying to put together a crew. Come out to LA, and I'll put you to work. This was like the year right after high school. And so me and my friend put all of our stuff in a U-Haul and a little truck and drove out here. And I had a vehicle too. You know, I think I had like $1,600 in my pocket, first last month's rent, you know, in deposit. And we got here and I went over to knock on my friend's door, like, knock, knock, knock. Hey, we're here. We're ready to start working. And he's like, oh, we didn't get the job. We're like, oh, what do we do now?
Yeah, seriously.
And I'm like, I guess we're going to go look for work. And we went, and my first job I got was sweeping up cigarette butts in Universal Studios in the back lot.
Oh, shit. What year was that?
That was 1989.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked for Pad.
Nice.
Yeah. And
then, no, I was asking because my mom used to work for Universal Studios. Yeah, yeah. She used to take us when we were kids, but that was like earlier 80s.
Early 80s, yeah. It was 1989. I was there for like 2 weeks and before I got my first like production assistant gig.
Okay.
And I started being a production assistant. And then it was like, I want to say 11 months or so before I got my first job make. Well, no, within like a month, I got my first special effects gig. Before I came out to LA, I'd already been out to LA one time before. When I was 16 years old, I won a national special effects makeup contest.
Oh, shit.
It was for, like, people 17 and under, and it was for the magazine at Forrest G. Ackerman.
Okay.
I was the editor.
Okay.
And so the people like Joe Dante, who did, like, Gremlins and The Howling.
Right.
And John Carl Beekler, who directed, like, Friday 13 Part 7 and Trolls and Ghoulies, they judged the contest, and they, you know, they picked me out of all these kids. And the prize was they would fly you out to Hollywood to meet everybody. So I already like had already met everybody. So
I was gonna ask like how you go to getting that job, like because there's no internet. You know what I mean? It's not like I can just go and look at your Instagram or your website or whatever. I have to like, is there like a portfolio?
I actually had a hard portfolio with like pictures in it, like a binder that would go and show people and stuff.
And then you got names of people you know that you
could. I had names and phone numbers, and I called people and let them know I was in town, and so word got around that I was in town, and. So when I first came out here, when I was 16, after I won that contest, I met Brink Stevens, who's one of my best friends. She's in all my horror films. She's a scream queen. And I met Sabin Gray, who was one of the photo editor for Forrest G. Ackerman on Monsterland magazine. And they had, see, now, because they're editor of a magazine, they knew everyone who was making horror movies. They knew Joe Dante. They knew, you know, Doug Beswick. They knew Jean-Claude Beekler. They knew everyone. And so when I got out here, finally, and I needed work, I was like, you know, called people, hey, I'm in LA now. I moved, you know. And then so the word got around and I got my first gig, like probably within a year. Yeah.
Nice.
And that was working for a man named Fred Olin Ray. And it was a movie called Evil Tunes, which is not the same as Terror Tunes, but it's Evil Tunes.
Got it.
And which turned out to be a big cult hit too. So,
nice.
Yeah. And Fred Olin Ray was a low-budget, micro-budget filmmaker, too, who had become successful. So, yeah, you know, yeah.
So what kind of stuff were you doing at that time?
Oh, like the very first thing I did was I made this, like, radio-controlled talking Necronomicon book. And it had to have eyes that opened up and the mouth had to move and demon teeth and a couple of kills on set, some simple stuff. And then I went right into working on a movie called Teenage Exorcist with Brink Stevens, where I did, like, this demon makeup on this guy and his... I guess they throw this book into the fire and his head blows up in fire and his eyeballs pop out and, you know, just, yeah. And then went moved on to like Auntie Lee's Meat Pies and, let me think, Night of the Demons 3 and the Wishmaster movies and, you know, just kind of barrel rolled into different things, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Man, it's such a long time, such history of movies in there, lots of gems in there.
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun stuff. I mean, time flies, you know. Time really flies when you're having fun, I guess. So.
It's crazy to me, too, because you go from being this kid who just wants to learn how to make rubber masks, and now you're making remote-controlled animatronic books, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Well, like that, those magazines and those fan pals I had, we used to do a thing where there was a magazine called Cinemagic where you could literally write an article about how you made something and send it to the magazine, and if it was good enough, they would print it in the magazine, and then everybody else would learn how you did it. And that magazine like taught me how to do like basic animatronics. They weren't really animatronics with electricity. They were more like push and pull kind of rods. Like that magazine taught me how to make like a hand like move like this, like a rubber hand.
Nice.
And then you could incorporate the same technology into like making a monster mask, mouth move, and this kind of simple stuff. So you know, as long as you had an understanding of the bare essentials of like what it takes to like make something like this, like sculpting it, molding it, and then puppeteering it, then you know, you're kind of a, and you're getting paid for it. You're a special effects artist, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But my first job after Universal was a big job was I did an episode of Roseanne Barr. It was like a month or so before after I quit working at Universal, and it was
this is the ABC sitcom Roseanne, right?
Yeah, I got my friend Jim Keegan, who worked for Monsterland magazine, said he knew I was in town. He's like, "Hey Joe, can you make a rubber mask? How long does it take you to make a mask?" And I'm like, "I don't know. How long do we have?" He goes, 24 hours. I'm like, really? He goes, what's it for? It's for Roseanne. It's John Goodman's Halloween costume.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, okay, how much are they going to pay us? And he's like, good. I'm like, okay, come on over. And we had 24 hours to make the masks and hand deliver them to the set.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and it was of the Three Stooges. It was like Curly and Moe.
Oh, okay.
They had sitting on John Goodman's shoulder. Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
nice.
I think we literally had like 8 hours to make them.
No way.
Yeah, yeah.
And you gotta do it.
You can Google it. It's like probably one of the most memorable episodes of the original series.
Okay. Okay, so you've been doing this for 42 years.
42 years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So along the way, you have to have a favorite or some favorites.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I'm curious
to know
what those are.
Yeah, yeah, that's I have to. So growing up, like I probably would say, like my all-time favorite horror movie is the original Poltergeist.
Nice.
Yeah, when I was like 12 years old, you know, back in the day, you know, movies really were big. Like summer movies were super big. You know, the whole theater was jam-packed. You know, on weekends, whatever. And when Poltergeist came out, it was so terrifying, especially for a PG film. I think I saw it 10 times in the movie, or maybe even 12.
Nice.
In fact, I was on a high school water polo team, and I tried to take my teammates to see it. I took all my friends from school to see it. I remember I took the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, son to see it.
Nice.
I wanted everyone to see it. It was like one of my all time favorites. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. But you know, then I get a little older, then I get more of a, like, I think, The City of the Living Dead came out in 1983, and if you've never seen that film, have you seen that film?
No.
When the drill goes to the guy's head and then he vomits up all the...
No.
Yeah, I saw that in the theater when I was 13 years old.
Nice.
And there's a reason why 13-year-olds should not see NC-17, you know, unrated Italian horror movies.
Because then you can't unsee
it. You can't unsee it.
Yeah.
It's like, I remember there's a scene where this drill is like gonna go drill through this guy's head, and in the Italian cinema, they like to like... You know, there's like high tension, and they like to like make the suffering like go on and on.
Right.
So this guy's like, you know, his head is being pushed towards this electric table drill, and then they cut to the drill, and they cut back to the guy's eye looking, and they cut to the killer pushing more, and then you go around and around and around. And I would like literally put my hand over my eyes because I just couldn't, you know. But it was great. Yeah, yeah. I'll never forget that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What do you think has been some of the challenges for you, you know, trying to make a name for yourself in the business?
I already know it.
You don't have to get so personal, but I ask because...
It's not personal. It's very, very... It's so obvious that it's easily discussed.
Mm.
I'm Hispanic, male. I am a gay man.
Mm.
Jealousy, envy, greed, hate.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All
Haters
those things.
Gonna hate.
Oh, yeah, no. It's, yeah. I mean, like, you know, being a Hispanic, first of all, being a Hispanic male is one obstacle alone. Being a Hispanic gay male is, it was like, you know, double threat for me. And, you know, I literally had, back in the mid 90s, there's like a very famous special effects artist who would go around telling people, Joe has AIDS. Don't hire him. He will bring AIDS to your special effects shop. Yeah.
That sucks.
And he's like super like popular special effects artist.
That sucks.
Yeah, and all because of jealousy. All because of jealousy. Because I was making movies. I was doing other things. I made a shot on 35mm feature film when this guy was just sculpting in a special effects shop at the time. So all jealousy, hate, greed, envy, this kind of thing, and. So funny, I confronted him about it once. He goes, yeah, you told me that. I'm like, first of all, why would anyone tell you that?
Right, right.
And then why would you think it would be okay to go and like tell a whole bunch of people
Repeat it.
No, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
He goes, you confided in me. I'm like, dude, you were stoned. Because I know you're stoned. You were stoned the whole time. He was literally stoned the entire time. So anyways, but yeah, it's all the same boring obstacles that most people face when it comes to, trying to make your way to the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Because in one respect, like, it makes you who you are. You have to fight for it a little bit harder.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you really want it, it's going to show. You're going to rise above it, and you're going to break through. But at the same time, if, you know, if people just were granted that opportunity to shine a little bit, you might get some really good stuff out of it.
Early on. Well, it's like, you know, like, I feel like as a gay man, a gay Hispanic male, not only do I have to be great, I have to be better than great just to be noticed, you know, because people will accept mediocrity, you know, and be comfortable with it. And
you know who has that outlook a lot? People who are like the most successful.
Yeah.
It's those ones who just never stop. They always have to rise above whatever comes, and they always have to be fighting for more. There's no days off. Always a grind.
Yeah.
You gotta and those are the ones that are the most successful at whatever it is that they're doing.
Thanks for saying that. I appreciate that.
Of course, man. Yeah. Okay, so what are some of your favorite projects that you've ever done? Like memorable stuff that you're like, dude, that was the best. Like, I can't believe we did that.
My favorite project I've ever done. Absolutely, 100%, without a doubt, is the original Terror Tunes. Probably my favorite project ever. I made this movie, my husband, Steven Escobar, and I produced and made this movie with our friend from Texas, Isaac Garza, and my best friend from high school, who wrote the screenplay, Rudy Bali, all four Hispanic males.
Nice.
We made this film called Terror Tunes, and we shot the entire movie in 3 days for $2,300.
Nice.
And I actually had budgeted the movie at $2,500.
Nice.
I gave it under budget.
Just don't tell anybody.
Yeah, and, you know, and how it came about is me and another friend of mine had an idea to make this movie about killer cartoons. And like within like a couple of weeks, my friend Rudy had already written the screenplay based on a storyline that I'd given him. And then there was a handful of people that I knew that I could count on to be like actors in the film. So I had them come do like a table read of the script. And everybody who showed up, I said, you get the part. And because I didn't really have much options. We were kind of like on a roll, and I didn't want to lose the steam of making the film.
Right.
And so yeah, everybody that showed up, and then, you know, there was like a little bit of, I had Hispanics in it, I had some blondes in it, I had some white boys in it, I had an Asian girl in it. It had, you know, a little bit of everybody was in it. So it all kind of seemed to work out. I even had like two characters of the parents of these kids in the film, and I had a guy to play the father. And then I had another guy to play the mother, and I just had him dress up in drag, you know what I mean? So, he didn't have a problem with it at all. In fact, he was a professional drag performer.
Nice.
And, but you know, it all worked perfectly the way it was like letting the universe like just flow and go with it. And that's the way it was accomplished in 3 days. And, I remember like we shot the first day in 12 days, second day in, I think it was like, oh no, sorry. The first day in 12 hours. The second day we shot was 17 hours. And then the third day we shot until it was done. So it was a 25-hour day.
Holy
I remember we were trying to get like the last shot of the killer, the main killer, getting his head cut with a giant axe. And the birds were chirping, and I could hear people like starting their cars to like get up to like leave for work.
You're like, shut the fuck up.
We were shooting in a garage, and we're like, okay. This is the last one we got to do. And my friends were there like helping me do the effects, the blood. And they had this hose attached to this chemical fire extinguisher.
Okay.
And because I wanted the blood to go everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And but I wanted the killer's blood to be candy apple red. I didn't want it to be like regular blood. I wanted it to be like cartoon blood. And so he had to use like a lot of like paint tint to get that color. You couldn't just get like a regular gallon of paint from the group.
Okay.
Yeah, and there was no other way to make it. So he's putting all this tint in it, and they forgot to like attach, because we're so tired. They forgot to like tape the tube to the other tube to go over the head. Action! And it's like, you know, 100 pounds of pressure. That tube went all over everybody and everything. I'm like, that's it. We're done. I'll fix that in post. And I remember going in, because we shot it at my boss's house, who had given us the money to make the film, and he was crashed on his bed. And I went into his bedroom, and I opened the door, and I said, we have a movie. He's like, great. You rolled over, went to bed.
Went back to sleep.
Yeah.
So of all the projects that you've worked on, right? Because if we look up your IMDb, it's dense.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's other ones too, like Blood Feast 2. I got a chance to work with Herschel Gordon Lewis. You know who Herschel Gordon Lewis is?
Doesn't sound familiar.
Jesus. Herschel Gordon Lewis is the man that invented the slasher movie. He invented it back in 1963. He directed a movie called Blood Feast, Gruesome Twosome, 2000 Maniacs, The Gore Gore Girls,
okay.
Wizard of Gore, all those movies. Anyways, his movies have been like Xeroxed, copied, mimicked, homaged over the decades. Everything comes from this man's original storyline, which is a deranged killer stalks innocent victims one by one.
Right.
Each victim dies on camera in a horrific, bloody, brutal death. And then at the end of the movie, the hero of the movie kills the killer in an even more horrific on-screen death.
Nice.
What is that? That is the formula of every slasher movie.
Right.
And that was in the movie called Blood Feast, yeah.
Okay.
So in 2001, I was working for the special effects company, and they were going to make Blood Feast 2, and he was going to direct it. And they asked the special effects house if they would do the special effects, and I don't know what happened there, but they were like, there's not enough money, blah, blah, blah. Hey, give it to Joe. He'll screw it up. Give it to Joe. Let him do it. I didn't know at the time, but these people were actually my worst enemy, and they wanted to see me fail. Like, give it to Joe. He'll screw it up, whatever. So they gave me the job. I took it. It was the biggest career move in my whole entire life.
Nice.
So I met the man that made the first slash movie ever. We became best friends. I totally hit a home run with all the effects in the film. The film was a big success. And I eventually, like, you know, this man became my mentor. He was in Terror Toons 3. And yeah, it was probably like one of the best career movies ever.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So. Well, of all the stuff that you have, you're credited for being associated with, you've done your fair share of directing. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about directing that maybe you just felt like wasn't your thing, or like, would you like to do more directing?
Yeah, no, I mean, would I like to do more directing? You know what I like to do whenever, I like to focus when I do stuff now. And I've done both, like where I wear all the hats and I direct when I do special effects. But I've gotten to a point where like my special effects work is so focus intense, like I like to focus on one thing at a time and do it perfectly, that if I'm trying to direct something and do special effects, you know, and wear too many hats somewhere, not everything can be a home run, you know what I mean?
Right.
Something's going to suffer along the way.
Right.
So if I direct
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah, I don't like that anymore. I like to focus on special effects or focus on directing, maybe a little bit of special effects in there, but I like to be a team player. I like to have a team of people around me when I do stuff now. You know?
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Okay.
I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. No.
I mean, I love directing, but I prefer like doing special effects because,
well, that's where the heart is, right? That's where you started, yeah. Right? And then you evolve and you're doing more things.
Yeah, and it's also like the kind of thing that like not everybody can do. So I kind of feel like there's a certain magic that comes with it when you're on set and you do something that no one else can do. You know, you're like, wow, how do you do that? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a one-of-a-kind feeling that you can only get if you are a special effects artist doing special effects on a movie set. Yeah.
Do you, as a special effects artist, do you watch stuff and like critique? You're like, I know how they did that. They cheaped out. They cut corners. Or by extension, do you ever get impressed? Do you ever see something and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's something I've been trying to do and I wonder how they did it.
Oh, absolutely. Like,
just hypercritical when you watch it now?
A couple of things. I'll start with something very, very complimentary. Like, it's taken me a long time to get here in this way of thinking, but I've become more teachable now than I've ever been in my entire life. Mm. Like, remaining teachable is super important. And what I've come to learn is that people in, like, their late 20s and 30s, I'm not going to cuss. They're know-it-alls.
Okay.
They think they're fucking know-it-alls. That's what I want to say. Right? And it's like a curse for them. They don't realize that people like, even like Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep, they still take acting classes. That's why they're so amazing. And so I remain teachable. And so, I mean, like, I learn from, like, you know, like 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds when I see their little techniques and stuff. Some guy sent me a picture of his very first special effect he attempted. It was like a burn makeup on his hand. And it's so good that I'm going to use that technique on something because
he
taught me something. So,
right.
Yeah. So there's that. There's like that way of looking at special effects in film. And then, of course, there is, here's the one, my biggest pet peeve. When you see a movie and it's super bloody And if you step back and you're like, wait, one person died here. Why is the entire room covered in blood? Because a human body doesn't have that much blood in it. It immediately is fake for me. Like, I'm like, oh, that's not right. That's not right.
Yeah,
isn't right. You know, like, if you see blood, like, squirting out of someone's head, blood doesn't squirt away from your body like that.
Yeah.
Blood runs down your skin.
Yeah.
You know, it's very natural looking. Yeah. That's why it's cinematic when that happens. When you see blood, like, squirting out of an arm like this.
Tarantino.
That's not blood the way it happens. It's like, I'm like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
What happened somewhere along the way, someone said, oh, there's so much blood shooting out. That must be amazing. And it's not. Look, that's cheap because you haven't figured out how to make it look real.
Well, like, I think it depends on like the setting, right? Like,
you can still have a very scary film that's funny or fun, and the effects can be very realistic. Like, look at the original Creepshow. The effects in that are super, super superior.
Right.
Tom Savini knew exactly what he was doing, even though it's still a comedy. It's a dark, evil comedy.
Yeah.
It's still scary and still funny. So that's a great example of like a perfect horror comedy.
Yeah.
I don't think people understand what horror comedies are. That's my biggest pet peeve. People call movies, say, horror comedies because they attempted to make a horror movie, but it was so goofy and it wasn't horror that they say, oh, it's a horror comedy. You know?
Yeah.
So there's that one. Okay, here's my other big pet peeve. When you look at a special effect, you're like, it doesn't look real. People don't know why it doesn't look real, but it's easily pointed out why it's not look. Most 9 times out of 10, the reason why a special effect does not look real because the blood doesn't look like real blood.
I hear the blood is like one of the hardest things.
And people forget that.
Yeah.
It's the color of the blood. I'm not going to tell you what I see because then I'll give it all away. But when I look at a special effect and I can tell why it's bad, I'm like, it's because of the color of the blood. Because it's the blood. It's the blood. People think pouring a whole bunch of blood on stuff makes it look real, but it doesn't.
No, I hear that a lot with blood specifically, that it's either the color or the consistency or both. And they say it's really hard to nail down. But once you get like a good kind of mixture, that people just kind of tend to stick with that mixture, and that's what it is. Unless obviously it calls for something different or whatever.
Well, there's different. I have different formulas of blood for different things. Like, I have a formula of blood that I use, like, if someone's wearing dark clothing. I have a formula of blood that I use if someone has very dark skin. I have a formula of blood that I use for people who are very light skin. I have a formula of blood that I use if blood is going to be shot at night and it's flying through the air. And I have a formula of blood that you could just literally pour into like a white sink.
Okay.
See?
Yeah.
So can you see how each of those things, the different textures
that
the blood has to go onto?
Yeah.
See? So there's I have a couple of different ones, but my favorite formula of blood I have is before Herschel Gordon Lewis died. He actually was the first man to exploit blood in motion picture cinema. Before that, Hollywood didn't exploit blood in the way that we're talking about.
Right.
There may be blood in a film, but it wasn't like exploited, especially with like nudity or death in the way that we like to watch people get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invented his own blood formula for Blood Feast. And before he died, he sat down with me and he told me what the original blood formula was. So I'm like the only person on the planet that knows it, except for my husband, because we recorded it.
The Colonel's secret recipe of herbs and spices.
And I still use it sometimes on movie sets. I'll bring it in. I'll say, this is Herschel's blood right here. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Because it still can be used. It still serves a purpose.
I'm curious now then, what's been like the biggest challenge for you from an effects perspective? Like, was there any one thing where you're just like, fuck, I can't get this thing, and you just try and try, and maybe it just took you forever, but you finally got it?
One of my biggest problems is that if you're a purist, an artist, like asking them to like duplicate something or make it twice is like it's like asking them to rip their fingernails off. They just don't want to do it. So I try to always like reinvent everything I'm doing. Like when it comes to like a throat cut or like a decapitation or ripping someone's, you want to do it like slightly different. Or like if someone asks you, hey Joe, can you make this for my film, and it's like a picture of somebody else's work, I'm like, no, I won't do that.
Right.
But I will reinvent it for you in a way.
Yeah, I got you.
You know, so I don't know if that answers your question about what's been a challenge or most difficult, but that's what's most difficult, having to reinvent it in a different way each time because I refuse to copy someone's work or duplicate something completely the way
that
somebody
makes sense.
Else has done it.
Yeah, I guess the question was more of like, you know, if there was any one particular effect
that you're just trying to pull off. Human skin is always a challenge.
Is it?
Yeah, it's always a challenge. Yeah, and I mean, I get sometimes I'm really good at it. Sometimes I'm under.
I see a lot of the shit that you post on Instagram. Like, it's fucking awesome.
Well, thank you, thank you. Yeah, you know, sometimes you know the universe is on my side and everything turns out perfect. And then sometimes you know I am. Sometimes I can be at like the mercy of like other people on set, like the director of photography doesn't know how to light a special effect, or the director doesn't know how to shoot the special effect from the right angle, and I'm trying to like tell them this is the best way to shoot it, and I'll like even like take a picture with my camera phone and say this is the best angle, and then they'll just like I don't go away, and then they'll shoot it from whatever the angle they want, and it's like they missed the whole boat.
That sucks.
Yeah, it happens all the time. In fact,
I was gonna ask if that happens more and more often, because I think we deal now, especially considering everybody's got a mobile like movie studio in their pocket. There's so much more indie film being created that I'm curious if, like, you know, you bring a 42 years of expertise and knowledge, and if people recognize that, or are they just quick to dismiss because they think that
the best people I work with, the best people that I work with, absolutely 100% acknowledge my skills, and they delegate the appropriate authority to me to do amazing things. Like Chad Farron is an amazing director. I've worked with him many, many different movies, Pig Killer and Unspeakable and Nightcrawler, and we just did a movie called Scalper together, and the old ones. He knows exactly how to shoot practical effects, and he knows how to delegate authority to me to get like the most. He gets the most out of me of anybody, and because he knows exactly how to do it. He knows how to collaborate with the artists that he hires.
Yeah.
That's a real team. That's how you make a real movie.
Right.
A real movie in Hollywood. And then you got people that are, you know, basically narcissists.
Right.
These narcissists that come in who believe they could do everybody's position better than them.
Yeah.
And they are basically sabotaging their own film.
That sucks.
It happens all the time. I will tell you right now, some of my best work will never be seen simply because they had no idea how to photograph it. In this very room right here, there was a werewolf transformation that was shot. I think I did like this entire werewolf transformation for like $500, and I made the full-on like American werewolf face, like a girl's face coming forward. And it's common knowledge whenever you're shooting a special effect, and the special effect is like moving through the frame, like if the face is moving this way, or head's being decapitated and it's going that way, an effect
like
is
the z-axis,
like an x to x, like back and forth.
Okay.
So moving through the frame, right?
Okay, got it.
You don't want to do it handheld because then you miss the motion, right?
Sure.
Right. So if this face is being stretched and you're like following it, you're not going to see it stretch. It's going to be in the middle of the frame the whole time.
Right.
That's exactly what this person did. He was filming I'm like, what did you do? You didn't even get the shot. So stuff like that. See, it's like little stuff like that. You don't even know until when it's done. You're just editing. You're like, oh, wait, he didn't even hold it steady.
Ugh.
So I can't even tell you how many times it happened.
Jeez.
How many times it happens. I'm not going to go into detail of that
one. It's all good.
Don't even go.
It's all good.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
Oh, wow. What am I working on now? I'm working on some really great films right now. Right now, I'm just finishing up a movie called Infernal. It's directed by Eric Mathis. Shot out in Vegas. And it's kind of like a demon rock and roll horror comedy. And it's got a whole bunch of cult movie stars in it. And it's got this guy in it, this big minotaur. And he breathes fire in it. And I'm right now I'm finishing up special effects for a new movie called Pool Party Massacre 2. And so it's directed by Drew Marvick, and Drew made the original Pool Party Massacre, and he's like really trying to up the ante on this one. And this is kind of literally the first film where the director came to me and said, Joe, I want you to be the director of special effects. I want you to, whatever you say, that's what we're going to do. And how much money do you need? Okay, I'm going to give you that.
That's gotta feel nice, right?
It that comes with a lot of
trust and confidence.
Yes, but that also comes with a lot of what? Responsibility.
Of course, yeah.
Responsibility. And I'm
now
like,
now you got to deliver.
The universe gives you everything you want, and now you have to deliver.
Right. It's like, careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. You know, and so that's where I'm at that today. And then I'm getting ready to do another film with Chad Farron. It's called Ed Kemper. It's about a real life serial killer. Chad's really a master of, he does these crime thrillers that are part slasher, but they're based on actual serial killers, you know, all around the world. And this is a guy named Ed Kemper. He I think he decapitated and mutilated these college girls, these hitchhikers.
Okay.
It's like back in the 70s when people could hitchhike and this kind of stuff. And he would pick up these girls and kill them. And then he killed his own mother and decapitated them. And super graphic stuff. Mm. But I like the fact that it's not funny at all.
Yeah,
it's super, super serious filmmaking.
Yeah, that's more of my style.
But with actual slasher gore in it, which is win for us.
Yeah. Nice.
And what else I got on the plate? We're getting ready to re-release The Summer of Massacre. Most people don't know this, but my husband and I have the Guinness Book of World Record for the highest body count in a slasher movie.
Get the fuck out of here.
You didn't know that?
No.
Yeah, we have the Guinness.
What movie is that?
It's called The Summer of Massacre.
Okay.
And it was released in 2012. And we're getting ready to, so in 2010, I went to school to learn CGI. And we started making the film, and I knew that I needed some other technology besides the rubber stuff to win a Guinness Book of World Record, right? I think at the time, the Guinness Book of World Record was 50 or 55 kills in a slasher movie. So we made a movie that had 155 kills. And
really kind of cement that record for yourself.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's a very specific world record. It's based on it has to be in a slasher movie. You have to have the person's face in it. You know, there's all these different little things that technical things that had to be checked off in order to get this record.
Sure.
So my husband and I, we worked on it for 2.5 years to put this movie together. But I was actually going to school, so I was learning how to do what I wanted to do. And when I look at my work today, it's it just needs a remix. It needs an update, kind of like Star Wars,
sure.
Things to do with Star Wars. So we're going to go back and we're going to do a brand new digital pass on the film.
Nice.
With a whole bunch of new practical effects as well. And we're going to beat our record. We're going to beat our record. So that's my big project that's on my plate right now.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Heck yeah. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. You talk about your husband every once in a while. I'm curious, anything you're comfortable with sharing, but I'm curious to know, how'd you guys meet? How does he fold into what it is that you do?
Yeah. So my husband and I met in an edit bay in San Antonio, Texas. I directed a movie called The Legend of the Chupacabra. And it was shot the same year they shot Blair Witch. And I shot it.
I was going to say it must be mid-90s.
Yeah, and I shot it. I shot it the same style as Blair Witch. So the Blair Witch people made the found footage film.
Yep.
And I made a found footage film the same year. And not Lionsgate. Lionsgate was going to pick up my film. They were a little company back then. They weren't Anchor Bay or what was the name of the company that distributed?
I think is it Anchor Bay?
No,
or was it just Anchor or something?
It was the company that released the original Blair Witch. They were going to put out that film, and then Lionsgate saw my film. But mine was more of it was campy. It wasn't as serious.
Got it.
And so they passed on it. But anyways, I was in the edit bay putting it together, and Steven came in to the edit bay with a director he was working with, and this guy grew up down the street from where I lived, the guy he was working with, and he didn't know if Steven was gay, but he knew I was gay, so he said, I'm going to introduce these two guys and see what happens. And then, so Steven and I hit it off, and
years later.
We've been together for 26 years now.
All right.
Yeah, 26
Congrats.
Years and married. Yeah. And but we've made 19 movies together. And Steve has an Emmy for outstanding editing.
Get the fuck out of here. That's
Emmy.
Awesome.
Yeah, Emmy for The Amazing Race.
Okay.
Yeah. But he's been nominated 4 times. And he edits all of our stuff. And he can take any movie and just magically make it better with his editing. I mean, he's super talented. Yeah, super
That's
talented
awesome.
Man. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool.
We work on all the work.
What a team.
It's great. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're talking a little bit about what you have going on, but I'm curious, can you show us some stuff?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me get this. What we were talking about.
Sure.
Okay. So, a lot of cool shit, man.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It takes a lot. I didn't do that by myself. My father was involved in that stuff, right? Of course, my upbringing, I have friends like Joe Gonzalez and you that are major players when it comes to pushing me to do my very best. And it's just this is a whole handful of people that brought me where I am today. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
Okay, will you close it there for me? Oh, and thank you. And You know, when you see a lot of great stuff, the first thing I think of is how many people have been kind and brutally honest with me at the same time to tell me the truth about what I was doing and what it looked like and how good it was or how good it wasn't, so that way I could learn from my mistakes. Because there's that fine line, right? You have that constructive criticism you get from people that are genuinely trying to be constructive and professional with you. And then, of course, you have, you know, people that don't know how to do that. So if I look back at all the people that, like I just had a serious conversation with Joe, like two days ago, that needed to be talked about, to be honest with you. It does. Certain things need to be said, you know? And sometimes they're painful, sometimes they may seem painful, but you have to do that in order to get better, you know, at what you're doing. Brutal honesty, yeah. So when you, like, I can't take credit for all of this stuff myself. You know, there's so many people that were involved.
That's very humble of you.
Like Steve provides this area that I work in. You know, I wouldn't have, like, I've been here in the studio for like 16 years now.
Wow.
And Steve helped, like, provided this outlet for me to be super creative in, you know, and like be able to.
That's
like,
awesome.
Yeah.
So any advice for anybody who maybe is trying to break into special effects, practical effects?
Yeah.
Just maybe even the movie business in general.
Yeah, start right now. Because just know that there are people that have like, you know, if you want to get into a creative field, you need to start immediately. There's just, because first of all, you'll never know everything. And if you want to be at the top of your game, like there are people that have been doing this for decades that have like the bridge between people who are starting and the people that are at the top of what they're doing is so far apart. I mean, there's so much, like, sometimes people will ask me questions online, like, Joe, how would you do this? And my response to them is, I feel uncomfortable telling you how I would do it, because then you may attempt to do it, but there will be things along the way if you attempt to do it that may, you may fail at, and then you'll be like, oh, well, Joe said to do it this way,
right.
And blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
You know, just little things like that. Or you may do something that will hurt, you might hurt yourself along the way. And I wouldn't want that. So
yeah, that's a good point. I don't think a lot of people have the outlook, or maybe even, I don't know if maturity level is the right way to say it, but to solicit suggestions, right? And then to put those things into practice.
Yeah.
And realize that it's not the person who told me how to do it this way. It's maybe my application, maybe I'm missing a component of it. It's easy to just say, oh, fucking Joe doesn't know what he's talking about.
And
disregard you.
Well, there's that. I don't know if you've ever taken like an online class, like especially in like a computer program or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some of these programs, the teacher has expectations of you to understand how to like save something, how to delete mm-hmm. something, how to mm-hmm. save a file.
Right.
You know these certain things. So they're not going to explain that.
Right.
And it's the same with
all
the stuff I'm doing here, there's a creative element to it, but basically it all boils down to chemistry and science.
Right.
And that's what I'm doing. I'm like applying these different chemicals to each other to get certain things, you know, and I'll watch people work and I'll be like, that's going to fail. Like, that's not going to work. I know, but ultimately, yeah, you know, but you know, I think the same goes for me. You know, I'll try something maybe three or four times before.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll get it just the way I want it, or whatever. Or
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely.
And then some kid will come in and go, oh yeah, we learned how to do it this way, and it's done. They do it like that. They show me how to do it.
Nice.
One up me, and you know, and I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Like
I said, I remain very teachable my entire career.
Yeah.
And so that's why I am.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, man. This was awesome. Thank you for inviting us in, showing us around. Hopefully, you know, we're going to push this out. More people are, you know, kind of drawn to who you are, what you do, and what you've done. They can go back and, you know, visit all of your past works, and then, you know, stay in the know of all the current stuff you're doing now, because it's all really fucking awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate
and
that.
I feel very blessed that you allowed us to come in.
Oh, it's an honor to be on
your
show.
All right, man.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, dude.
All right.